The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of Zach on Film. Joining this week, like always, Steven Schleicher.
Hello.
Steven, you know, the world is kind of seems to be destroying itself most days, so I didn't feel like there was any reason for us to go to the theaters and watch aliens destroy the world.
I wish I could find this tweet. I forget who said it. I think it was Michael Nelson. Makes me sad that the new Independence Day is so bad. I don't want it to overshadow the fact that the first one was so wretchedly awful.
Yeah, so we did not go watch Independence Day. What was it, Resurgence? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, Independence Day.
Bugaloo?
Yeah. Independence Day, hey, let's tell the same story twice.
Hey, Independence Day, to the moon!
Yeah.
So instead, we decided to stay home in our comfy living rooms.
Yeah.
And watch a movie that we unfortunately missed in theaters.
Thanks, AMC.
Thanks, AMC. And so we are talking the Coen brothers' latest film, Hail Caesar, this week on Zach on Film.
Yeah, so Hail Caesar gives us a little slice of life of what it's like to run a Hollywood studio during the time of
50s.
50s, yeah. as we move into the Blacklist and everything. Because that Blacklist surprisingly plays a big role in this movie.
Yeah, I felt while I was watching this that this is, if you have followed along with Zach on Film, this is the culmination of like the entire series. Because it is like every film we watch. I mean, just within the last, you know, year, if you look at
Trumbo,
and then Ben-Hur is a big plot through like the kind of this whole Hail Caesar, and then you look at like Grace Kelly stuff with Singing in the Rain, and I'm trying to think what else. They really kind of tapped into, and well, any of the westerns we've watched are all kind of play into this movie, which is awesome from my standpoint.
It really turns out that we're looking at kind of a the Coen brothers' love affair with vintage Hollywood, right? So every genre that you can think of, Western, big budget spectacle, musical, as you're saying, it's all there. And in many cases, the little vignettes are couched so that they can say, hey, let's introduce you to this idea. So, for example, the Channing Tatum character is he plays a dancing sailor guy.
Right.
And so when there's an exchange of this money for the lead actor that they're trying to get back to the studio, our hero, our studio head, played by Josh Brolin, has to go to one of the sets and put it behind one of the electrical circuits. And while he's waiting for something to happen, he watches the filming of this musical number that has Channing Tatum dancing and singing and doing all the things that they do about something about seamen.
Sailors going away.
Oh, yeah. Sailors and seamen and stuff.
Yeah, sailors and seamen.
And so we get that little look, and then it's like, okay, that seems to be just a little throwaway scene until later you realize that the Channing Tatum character plays a bigger, darker role in the overall storyline.
Yeah.
So it's very well done. It's very well crafted. I enjoyed it a lot. I saw this when it first came out on iTunes. So this has been probably about a month or so, I think, when it came out, and I really enjoyed all the little bits and pieces that they threw in there. And especially because, as you said, we've been doing Zach on Film for so long, this really touches on, it's like a refresher course for everything that you've supposedly learned all these years. So I thought it was good.
Yeah. So it follows Josh Brolin's character, who's head of this, film studio. What was it called? Capitol Pictures.
Capitol Pictures. Yeah.
Which when I was reading, I have not seen the Coen brothers. What is it? Barton Fink.
Yeah, you've never
movie.
Seen that.
I've never seen that. Yeah. They said this is like a continuation of that because they said they established, like, okay, so maybe not a continuation, but Capitol Pictures is something that's in that film and that this is like a decade after it.
Okay.
Continuing on.
Well, considering that people essentially all died in Barton Fink.
Yes, I don't even know what Barton Fink is. I just read an article. I don't remember which one it was.
I mean,
talking
I can
about
see
how
that.
It was the it, like Capitol Pictures came from that, and then it's a decade later after that movie.
I mean, I wouldn't say it's a sequel, but okay. You know, obviously, but it's kind of like when you're watching a Quentin Tarantino movie and he's got the candy apple cigarettes in there, or you know, a lot of these things resurface. So
Okay. Yeah,
maybe the Coens are creating a cohesive universe, but I would say this is not definitely not a sequel to.
Okay.
Barton Fink at all.
Okay. So we're following Josh Brolin's character through this, and he's the studio exec, and he's helping all these pictures go together. And George Clooney plays one of the title characters.
Baird Whitlock.
Yeah, Baird Whitlock. He's the lead in Hail Caesar, which has totally not been her. And he's the biggest movie star in America right now. Mm-hmm. And he gets kidnapped.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. And who kidnaps him, Steven?
The communists.
Oh, no. The communists are back.
And which is really funny because the communists, as they're revealed, are really the socialists led by essentially the Hollywood 10. And
yeah.
if you've watched Trumbo and you've talked about and you've listened to us talk about the Hollywood blacklist, it's real easy to point out, well, there's Trumbo, there's, you know, his sidekick, and there's, I mean, you can, if you've, and I think what happened was we watched Trumbo, and like the very next week I saw this movie, so I was like, oh, there's that character, that character, that character.
That's funny.
And of course, they're kind of played off as kind of blind followers to this cause, and they, to the point where they even convince Baird that their cause is a right one, and that everybody should be getting paid the same amount, and socialism, and rah, rah, rah. To where George Clooney's character is like, yeah, I really am into this. This is really cool. You're right, guys. We should do this. Only to realize later on that it really is a communist plot to try and overthrow Hollywood, led by Channing Tatum.
Channing Tatum's character.
Who's introduced early on. And then it seems to be a money caper. You know, the Baird is kidnapped for all this money, which supposedly was going to be distributed by the Hollywood 10 in this picture. And the characters are not called the Hollywood 10. They're not. They don't go by Trumbo. They go by a bunch of different names, and most of them are unnamed in the movie. So don't think that this is the Coen brothers making commentary on their views on Trumbo or anybody like that.
Yeah, no, not at all.
But the writers are all a bunch of bumbling guys, and they give this, what is it, $10 million or something?
$100,000
off to Channing Tatum, who then gets on aboard a Russian submarine to go back to the motherland. And he loses all the money in the process.
Yeah, which was really funny. And I wanted to talk about, because all these guys are rowing Channing Tatum like he's George Washington through the water. And this Russian sub just comes right off the coast of California. Channing does his great, graceful leap onto the sub. And he's about ready to go off and be the communist that he is. Back in the motherland, and they threw him this briefcase, and then his dog comes and he catches his dog, and the briefcase falls in the water. Everyone just looks at it and goes,
"Yeah,
all right, like, see you later." Okay, well, I was like, "What in the heck is that even mean? Are they trying to say here?" Because it's like that is like the plot of the movie, and then there's like, "I forget the money."
Well, I mean, why should you be concerned about money, right? I mean, it's the loss is not a big deal to the communists because you didn't have anything before. You have nothing now.
I guess that's true.
And you still have nothing now. So it kind of works out in that way. And for the writers, I mean, they're giving the money to the Russians. So
that's true. They didn't really lose anything.
You know, I think it was implied that they kind of wanted a cut, but they were okay to give it all to the big cause back home. And so, yeah, that's kind of wrapped up. But in the process, Josh Brolin, and we're really talking about the third act here, but
yeah,
I mean, Josh Brolin's character shows up, rescues Baird Whitlock, gets him out of there just as the police are showing up to raid the place. And so everybody who was there except for Baird, who is their big Hollywood star, is safe from scandal, which is kind of what Josh Brolin's character is doing, which I was surprised, really honestly, I was surprised that he is the head of the studio or the local head of the studio. I mean, he's just basically running it for the New York corporations as opposed to him being the studio's fixer.
In
the studio fixer, it was this kind of like guy who kind of knew everything and did everything and was okay with fixing up a murder scene or getting a star or starlet out of a tough situation and really kind of smoothing over any problems. And so I was really surprised that he wasn't a fixer in this movie, but rather somebody who's rather important in this studio, which also does kind of play into the fact that he is so important at the studio that a lot of people want him. He understands that the movie system is not making as much money as it was before. He is working for other people. He's not the boss. He's not always calling the shots on everything. He's covering up other people's scandal. And he is being courted by
Lockheed Martin
to come and work for them and make 10 times what he's right. making at the studio. So in his Catholic guilt, because it does come off that he's Catholic, because he goes and sees that, goes to confession like every single day. you know, he wanders and ponders, you know, what should I do? Should I stay with this studio that needs me and that, you know, I make work, or do I go to this other place and hope to make, you know, a bunch of money mm-hmm. from it? And my wife and family and everybody can do so much more. So I found his struggle interesting. But I think in the end, he realizes, you know, that all this craziness that goes on with me having to go and find money men and hook starlets up yeah. and make sure that this pregnancy scandal goes away or whatever, that's more enjoyable than running an air company.
Yeah. And I also thought one of the subtexts that definitely, I don't know if it was a subtext, that the Lockheed Martin guy really continually puts down mm-hmm. what he does and in the whole Hollywood system in general mm-hmm. as this frivolous, barely a money-making thing, and they're all right. just playing pretend all this time.
Right.
And I like to think that our main character realizes kind of the importance of film and what it kind of plays mm-hmm. in as the society as large as mm-hmm. while they are creating something and Lockheed Martin is just showing off how they can make a giant H-bomb and blow right. up islands and stuff.
Right, right, right.
And so I think he sees past this, you know, this arms dealer trying to be like, oh, you guys do nothing. We do real things. You come be with us and make a bunch of money mm-hmm. and make a difference, when he sees eventually in the end that they do make a kind of a difference in yeah. society.
And this, I don't think it has an exact year in here, but we know it takes place in the 50s. So it happens right after or right around the same time that vertical integration, the United States versus Paramount, took place mm-hmm. in order to bust up the monopoly. So mm-hmm. studios are kind of in a tough spot at this time, right? Where they no longer can force distribution into specific theaters and guarantee distribution. They don't own everything from top to bottom. You know, the whole distribution and theater ownership was spun off and forced out of their hands. And so, you know, from Brolin's character's perspective, yeah, the question of what's going to happen with the studio is there, mm-hmm. right? I mean, television is starting to become more popular mm-hmm. and people may not be going to the pictures and as much as they used to. And then you have the cowboy character, the singing cowboy guy, Hobie Doyle.
Yeah, Hobie Doyle.
You really start to see what's going on with these really cheap B-movie type things. And is that even a venue that they want to continue doing? Mm-hmm. So it's very fascinating look in a humorous, tongue-in-cheek way at that period in time in the studio system. And I really got a kick out of it.
You know, we kind of mentioned at the beginning when we talked about the different mm-hmm. aspects of that kind of decade in film history they touch on. And a lot of it is kind of vignetted in a way where mm-hmm. no one really gets a lot of screen time besides Josh Brolin. And which I was surprised with, because when this movie was marketed, it's like Josh Brolin, right. Scarlett Johansson, Channing Tatum, mm-hmm. Seth Rogen's friend, yeah. and Voldemort. They're right, all in this
right,
thing.
Right, right, right. I forgot Voldemort was in here.
Yeah, he's Lawrence.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, they have all of these Ralph little Fiennes, bits yeah. are good, and I really enjoyed them.
Mm-hmm.
But they're definitely not like main players throughout the story. Mm-hmm. And kind of from my point of view, it seemed to break up the pace of the film maybe a little too much for my taste,
mm-hmm.
where we do kind of watch a movie on a movie screen while we're watching a movie
mm-hmm.
For a while. Like, we watch dailies of Hail Caesar.
Right.
And in the new film that Hobie Doyle's in. Mm-hmm. And we just are like watching dailies for a little bit, which is interesting. But did you feel like it kind of broke up the pace a little too much?
I think it does, because if you're just trying to follow the story of Eddie Mannix and then you have to spend, you know, 10 minutes of Hobie Doyle and his date that they fixed him up with at his premiere of The Singing Cowboy or whatever it is, and you mm-hmm. have to watch that whole first opening musical number of that in the piece, I think it does. But at the same time, as I was watching, I was like, you know what? This doesn't really drive the Eddie Mannix story, the Josh Brolin character story forward. But it does show that the Coens are mixing all these genres together, all mm-hmm. these different styles together, And, you know, because they're blending in kind of a noir tale with Mannix character. Mm-hmm. They're building in some stage comedy bits with the communists and everything mm-hmm. that's going on there, because it's basically people sitting around. And so you're getting silent slapstick or silent comedy bits there. You've got musical dance in two different kinds. You not only have Channing Tatum dancing, but you also have Scarlett Johansson doing her mermaid.
Yeah, her little water picture.
You've got the cowboy picture, bee picture. I mean, you're taking all these different genres, and the Coens are saying, look, we can do this kind of a movie. We can mm-hmm. do this kind of a movie, and we can do it technically and aesthetically correct, as opposed to trying to force a musical number into a noir film and still keeping the musical number all noir. They're basically saying, hey, look, here's what the musicals were like. Here's what the highbrow dramas were like. Mm-hmm. Here's what all these things were like. And I think from that perspective, I kept watching going, oh, are they going to flub up on something, or are they going to nail each of these different genres, different kinds of films from those periods? And I think that's what they did wonderfully. And I think that's what ultimately holds the movie together, is your interest in, oh, what are they going to explore next? Or what are they going to make a commentary on next? Because the dancing sailor number is full of sexual innuendo.
Oh, yeah, it's
to
great.
The point where it's just it's riotous in the fact that they're playing it straight. Yet it is, you know, super... super sexual innuendo left and right. So it's great how they did that.
Mm-hmm. And if you've never seen a lot of those films, mm-hmm. watching this gives you probably like the best bits of all that genre. Because even the like the bee cowboy movie, you mm-hmm. get to see Doyle just whipping it around on a horse,
swinging
and flinging
his gun
through a tree.
Around.
Yeah, and you see him. It's not actually in the film, but doing his lasso tricks while mm-hmm. he's waiting for his date.
Mm-hmm.
The Channing Tatum dance sequence is phenomenal.
Oh, it's really great.
It is so good. And there is the great thing about that where, especially that scene where it looks like you're looking at through the camera lens like mm-hmm. the film would be, but then they will pull out and you kind of see like stage hands putting stage and the mm-hmm. sets moving around.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably one of the most impressive sequences in this film for me, especially when they're tap dancing on the tables and the guy's pulling all mm-hmm. the stuff.
Oh yeah, it was executed
scene.
Tremendously well.
Yeah.
I thought it was really, really nice. And at the same time, I think that is where, as you said, the movie fails in that it does break up the story.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who are not interested in vintage Hollywood,
mm-hmm.
that becomes boring very quickly.
Sure.
You know, and mm-hmm. especially, and the big complaints that I saw when this movie first came out is, hey, I thought Channing Tatum was supposed to be this big to-do, and Ralph Fiennes was supposed to be this big thing, and it's like, they're in, you know, who did you say, his friend, the accountant guy.
I don't know why I can't ever think of his name. It's
Jonah Hill.
Yeah, Jonah Hill.
So Jonah Hill, who plays Joe Silverman, who is kind of like an attorney, accountant.
He's a people person.
Yeah, he's a people person.
That's what they describe him as.
You know, he's in like two bits. And those bits are less than 5 minutes
mm-hmm.
Each in the movie. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you watch the trailer, it feels like, oh, Jonah Hill's going to play a big part in this. And he really doesn't.
No.
Which is okay, too, because that's another thing that I think we see a lot in Coen Brothers movies, where you're like, oh, there's that guy and there's that big star and there's these people. And, you know, it's come to the point, I think, with the Coens that if they ask you to be in their movie, you jump at the chance to be in the movie,
even
if it is something as simple as Jonah Hill just stamping out some receipts and filling a briefcase full of money and then end up marrying Scarlett Johansson's character in the end.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's fine. I think it's fine to stock it full of well-known names. And then I don't want to say cast them aside, but then they are in really minor roles, because I think that makes it a little bit more exciting.
And it does kind of play at that Hollywood thing where you just have these big name characters doing these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so if they really are going to play that up to a point that even we can establish what that era is like, is like
right.
we do have to put the biggest names in mm-hmm. Hollywood in these little bit roles.
Yeah.
Because in the films they're starring in, they are, you know, the cat's meow,
mm-hmm.
As we take it old school there. But yeah, it is. I mean, because Ralph Fiennes in his scene when he's making that movie is hilarious.
Where I think he's supposed to be what, Preminger or somebody like that. He's just really dictatorial German director that gets to the point where when Hobie can't, because Hobie has a very Western drawl because mm-hmm. he plays cowboy stuff, and he's been cast in this very highbrow drama, and so he can't talk highbrow. And Fiennes is trying to teach him to the point where he starts slapping him every time slapping him hard across the face every time he messes up. And it's like, first it's shocking, And then it's kind of funny, and then it gets really uncomfortable, and then gets really uncomfortable, and then you feel sorry for Hobie's character. So you go through all these emotions each time he's getting smacked around. It's great.
And he's trying to get him to do this pronunciation right, and it is like a four-minute scene of them just trying to do this pronunciation, and I'm watching it, and Aubrey's off in another room, and they're just saying this one line over and over. Aubrey's like, what is going on? And I'm just dying laughing, because it's such a funny scene.
Yeah, I think it was. There are just a bunch of little gems in here hidden away that make this funny. And unfortunately, though, I don't think this is a movie for everybody.
No, it definitely lacks, I would say, universal appeal, but I would say even kind of like an American appeal, where if this movie could have been made with the foresight like 20 years ago, it probably would have been a hit. But we've moved.
I don't even know if it would be. I guess 20 years ago.
I was thinking that like the 80s, or something,
the 90s. If people are comparing it to Barton Fink, you walk away from Barton Fink and you're like, what the F is going on? This is the weirdest movie I've ever seen. This is kind of that.
Okay.
You know, but both, I think, Barton Fink and Blood on the Highway, whatever that movie was that they did, the Blood Simple, are kind of straight up serious pieces. And I like it when they go around into funny bits. I know a lot of people went into Hail Caesar hoping that this was going to be another the Dude movie.
Big Lebowski.
And it wasn't. I mean, it's clearly not that. And so I think you really have to get in the mindset of, this is not what I think it is, but I'm going to sit and I'm going to enjoy it regardless. But if people are going in going, oh, this is the next Lebowski, or this is another, you know, hit Coen Brothers movie, this definitely is not Oh Brother, Where Art Thou in its execution at all.
No.
But it is, I think it's a very fine tale, and I think it's well-crafted, and I think all the set pieces that they put in there, they have mimicked the style and the genre and the look perfectly, because when they're doing the singing cowboy opening montage stuff, I mean, that is straight out of a 1950s movie. I mean, they've done that perfectly. So it's nice to see that stuff, that they get the lighting down, that they get the camera angles down, that they get the type of lens, the focal length that they would have used in those pieces downright. And so it would be interesting to just read a very long interview or see an interview with the Coens to see their methodology behind the madness of this movie, in that, well, we decided that we wanted to do it this way and that we decided to use these kinds of techniques to tell our story. And I think it worked really well.
Just sticking with the production side, there is an interview with the cinematographer, an American cinematographer, Roger Deakins, and he talked about trying to get that right look in a lot of the bits. And a lot of it was about all the lighting and stuff. But I found it interesting that they used a more modern film camera. Mm-hmm. It was an Arri film camera,
right?
With Zeiss primes. And he said they could have shot it at, you know, like an F1.8 or I guess T1.8.
Yeah.
But they knew that in that era, just because of the lens quality, that they needed to shoot at around five to get the right
and get,
you know,
a long,
the little sharpness,
long depth of field.
Yeah. And
in
so
there.
That's what they stuck around. He's like, we could have, you know, with stuff we were using, we could have looked at the 1.8, but they pretty much shot four, five, and five.
Yeah, because, you know, even in the kitchen scene where Eddie goes home, and he goes home just to eat dinner, say goodnight to his kids, and then he's right back to work. I mean, he barely has any time with his family. And yet, while he's sitting at dinner having a conversation with his wife is in the background, and you really see the crazy architecture, too, of that time period. But his wife is putting away dishes and cleaning up and stuff, and because of that long focal length, you get to see what's going on behind them. Mm-hmm. Likewise, when we're with the main character, George Clooney's character.
Oh, yeah.
And he's waking up and he's having the conversations with the communist writers. Mm-hmm. You can only get the comedy by using a deep focal length, because you need to see all of their blank expressions as Clooney doesn't understand what they're talking about when you have to share things. And then just like, what do you mean you don't understand how we share things kind of stuff? It's classic. I mean, I was really surprised to even see Fisher Stevens as one of the communist writers in the piece. And he's not even the Trumbo character in the piece. It's just great just to kind of look and see, oh, there's that character, and that character. And you know what's interesting? I've been watching a lot of the Thin Man movies. In fact, I've watched all the Thin Man movies that are available.
What are the Thin Man movies?
They're a series of comedy mysteries.
Oh, okay.
Takes place in the 1930s. So it's black and white. But not the 1930s, maybe 1940s or 30s through the 40s. But it's interesting because you start to see a lot of recognizable characters in the roles, and this was an early role for them. Like Jimmy Stewart plays a bad guy in one of the movies, and it's like, oh my God, that Jimmy Stewart, and he's got to be an unknown at this time. And so I think that kind of doing that with the cast here also throws that in, because you're like surprised going, oh, there's Jonah Hill, or oh, there's Tilda Swinton, or there's she was great. She plays two different characters in there. Or even when you see Frances McDormand playing the editor of a movie, it's all great stuff. So I think part of it is, oh, there's that person, kind of also helps in the enjoyment of the movie.
You mentioned the editing sequence. When we're watching this, we're watching the dailies of this Lorenz picture with Cowboy Guy, and they're watching the dailies, and all of a sudden the screen kind of starts, you know, bubbling up like something wrong with the film. You look over there, and, you know, because it was playing out, as you mentioned, Brolin's story is kind of film noir-ish in the it's presented. I'm like, is she dead? Did someone kill her in the editing room? And of course, no. They set it up earlier, but her scarf was like ran right through the film.
Yeah, through the moviola. And and then she's like, reverse. And it's really great. I mean, even the little bit parts. Even Jonah Hill, and we've mentioned his name multiple times. Even though he is in such a small part, I really like his character, and I really like what he brought to that character. So,
and and speaking of the historical accuracy, there in the editing sequence, there's a woman editor. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I always remember from your editing class was back in that time period, it was mostly women who were editing all of the big pictures, which, you know, surprised me, because based off of you see like men behind directors and cinematographers and stuff, to see that their women were so prevalent in the editing rooms.
Well, in the early days, it was considered equivalent to sewing, that editing was like sewing. And so sewing was, and again, not my words, their words, is women's work. So that's why you would employ women as editors. But, you know, there were a lot of men editors too. One of the biggest, I forget which studio it was at, but the head of the editing department was female, and she ran the entire department of editors. And so if there was a problem, she would come down and yell at people. And she was very well respected for a long time. I'm sorry, I can't remember her name. But women as editors for a long time have been a big deal. And if you look at Spielberg, if you look at Tarantino, they've always had female editors as their editors, just because they believe that there's a much different approach than what you would typically expect. So
yeah,
it's interesting.
And, so here's my question. You lived out in California for a while. You've kind of been in that area.
Yeah.
How expansive the studio set or lot was very surprising to me. I've been around Universal, the theme park, and you can kind of see some back lots there. And I don't remember there being that many sets. Yeah. Is it still that expansive?
I would say yes.
Oh,
I would
really?
Say it is, because, you know, once you build it, you can do whatever you need to with it. And in some cases, you have sets that are there that are in use for 2 or 3 years just for a single movie. Or in the case of what Lucille Ball did, and many people don't realize that Desilu Studios, her and Desi Arnaz, they owned the studio outright. They owned all the sound stages. And then after Lucy basically retired from doing her shows, she was making millions of dollars because she was renting out her studio, the actual studios, to different people for movies or television shows. You know, a lot of television shows still shoot on a studio lot. Mm-hmm. And so they still use all that space. So, yeah, in fact, I was just reading, was it Universal? Somebody had just announced a massive expansion of their studio lot.
Oh, really?
Over the next, I think, 10 years. I'd have to go back and look. It's online somewhere, but they had just recently announced a massive expansion. I think it's over the next 10 years to add in 15 more studio spaces.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it just because it's so much cheaper to film on a lot? Is that why, with the main draw?
Well, I mean,
you don't have to
go out and haul things around. I mean, all of your equipment is right there. You don't have to go out onto location. And if you're doing a studio show like The Tonight Show or Jimmy Kimmel or something like that, you build the set, it's there for as long as you need it to, and so people can go to there. It's very centralized in that aspect. I think there's a big benefit to having the lots available for you. And again, if you can own it, then you don't have to rent it from someone else. Now, granted, they're going to be paying off, you know, the stuff for a long time, but, you know, the system charges itself to where it will pay itself off, and then after that, it's just money that the studio makes. It's another incentive. And really, if you talk to Jason Inman or Ashley Victoria Robinson, studio space is at a premium. I mean, it's really hard to find good, cheap studio space. And even in the case of another piece, the Axanar Star Trek movie, I mean, they had to go in and renovate a space for their fan film. And so they had to spend something like $500,000 just to renovate a space and build a new floor and all this stuff. So, yeah, shooting on location is not great. And there's a lot of things that can go wrong. But if you can keep a studio quiet, I mean, you can just do whatever you want. You can craft whatever you want. You can control the light. You can control the sound. You can control the temperature. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there's a big advantage to being inside of a studio.
In the realm of Coen brother movies, is this something you would expect from them kind of at this point in their career?
No, actually.
Yeah. Well,
I was really surprised. I mean, this is what I would expected earlier in their career where they're really experimenting and trying different things.
Mm-hmm.
From the story perspective and from what they were trying to do. This is really something I would have expected years ago, even before Raising Arizona. I would have expected it right around there or right even before Big Lebowski or something, or right around the same time as Big Lebowski.
Mm-hmm.
But then, because really, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And what was their last movie that they did before this? Was
the last ones they directed were Inside Llewyn Davis, which I haven't seen yet. That's with Poe Dameron.
Yeah.
And then True Grit. Did
they True Grit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's A Serious Man, Burn After Reading. Yeah. I think the thing is that they have done some very good things that have allowed them to say, you know what, we want to do something different and experimental again. Mm-hmm. And so because of their past success, this has allowed them to do this. But this movie also couldn't have been done at the same time that they were doing Hudsucker Proxy or Fargo, because I don't think they may not have been equipped enough to really nail the different genres that they were trying to emulate in mm-hmm. the movie. And I think they needed some extra time to develop skills and whatnot.
Yeah. Doing a film like this, when we run through all the different styles mm-hmm. they were able to show, seems like a movie you would want to do in the beginning of your career for it to be successful, because then you show people, like, look at all that I can do in one film.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, if this had been done early in their career, it would have been a failure, and it probably would have prevented them from doing other movies like Hudsucker Proxy, which in itself, Hudsucker Proxy, when you think about it, is just kind of like this weird, okay, kind of, you know, schlubby guy does good kind of stuff, and it has something bigger at the end of it. But it's, again, as you look at the evolution of the movies of the Coen brothers, they get better and better and better with each one as they tackle different genres, as they tackle different themes and topics, because Hudsucker Proxy, while it may be a comedy, is not the kind of same comedy that you see in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, or in The Lady Killers, or in any of that stuff. And then you see them get to do westerns and serious stuff with True Grit and No mm-hmm. Country for Old Men and these others. So it really, I think that this is a movie they could have only done now, but I don't think it's one of their best films.
Do you think it would be considered a success because it did only have a $22 million budget, mm-hmm. but it made $30 million domestic and $63 worldwide?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that would be enough to cover marketing and all that good stuff?
They didn't do a whole lot of marketing with this movie.
Oh, they didn't?
No. I mean, it seemed to be like two trailers and that was it. And I don't remember seeing a whole lot of marketing online mm-hmm. and in other places. I really didn't see it. So I think the studios knew that this was a small project, that it was a low budget project, that it probably wasn't going to have the turnaround that they expected.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was promoted exactly that way. And because it didn't have a wide release, I mean, we thought we were going to have it here, and then they yanked it at the last second because they're like, we don't think very many people are going to be interested in the movie. And then they tried to bring it out the next week or something.
I think it came for like 4 days.
And then because first they said no, cause there's not enough interest. And then right around the time that they were doing the premiere of it, everybody got super excited about the movie again.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it rushed into the theater for, like you said, a couple of days here, and then it bounced back out again.
Yeah, quickly left.
Yeah. It's a small indie movie, and I don't expect that to be a big, big draw here in the middle of nowhere.
We talk about all of the kind of the weird stuff the Coen brothers have done, and they've, you know, they have been, I would say, successful on a couple of different levels, especially, I mean, they get nominated for mm-hmm. a lot of Oscars. Yeah. Inside Llewyn Davis got nominated a lot. Do you think the Coen brothers have a name in the general public enough to draw a lot of interest to a film, or do you think that their name isn't enough pull factor for a lot of people to just go see it off that?
I don't think that they're I don't think their name factor is big enough. I mean, I think if you weren't to the average person and said, hey, do you know the Coen brothers in their movies? Mm-hmm. I think because of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, a lot of people would recognize their names. But if you told them, hey, they've also directed these movies, people would go, I've never heard of that movie, mm-hmm. or I didn't like that movie, or, oh yeah, that was a fun movie back then. I didn't know they were still making movie kind of stuff. So they've done a lot of small stuff that has had success. And I think, I don't know, my personal view is that I think that they're happy doing small films and that they don't really need to tackle something like True Grit a lot, because they can tell a great story in Raising Arizona that gets a lot of attention and a lot of people excited, but it, again, doesn't cost that much and wasn't super hard to produce.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Are you in general just a fan of the Coen brothers at all?
I do like them. I mean, I don't know if when I was looking at their entire list of movies, I can't say that I have seen all of their movies, but I would say I've seen most of them. If I were to go into Joel Coen's directing, if we look at him as a director, I've seen Blood Simple, Raising Arizona. I've seen bits of Miller's Crossing. I've seen Barton Fink, The Hudsucker Proxy, Fargo, Big Lebowski, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I went and saw The Man Who Wasn't There, which is an interesting noir movie. Mm-hmm. I saw it like on Christmas Day in 2001, and there was nobody in the theater.
Oh, really?
I mean, nobody. There were like five people in the theater, and the film broke twice.
Oh, geez.
I've not seen Intolerable Cruelty. I have seen The Lady Killers. I've not seen No Country for Old Men. Burn After Reading, I've seen. A Serious Man, I don't think I've seen. True Grit, yes. Inside Llewyn Davis, I have not seen. And Hail Caesar. So I would say I've seen about 80% of their stuff.
Okay.
And I enjoy it. I mean, I like what they do.
Yeah, I think I've only really seen, this is probably only my third film that I've actually seen. For some reason, I haven't seen Fargo.
Really?
Yeah, I haven't seen most of their mid-2000s stuff. I've seen True Grit, but anything between there and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I haven't seen either.
I think maybe we should watch Fargo.
Oh, yeah?
Because it's really good. Now, you haven't seen the TV series, right?
No.
Okay.
No.
I think we should watch Fargo for next week.
All right. That'd be fine with me.
Because, and I bet Matthew and Rodrigo would jump on board for that, too, because Fargo is a super interesting movie, which, of course, has spun off into a TV series, sure. which really expands upon the story that they've told here,
uh-huh.
which in itself is based on true events.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think Fargo would be something that you'd really get a kick out of.
Yeah, I'd be fine with that. It's always nice when I just mentioned a movie, like, yeah, we should totally do that.
I really thought you had seen Fargo.
No. Yeah, there's really nothing coming out this holiday weekend anyways.
Well, and that's interesting, too, because
besides the Purge election year, because that I find interesting and want to see.
It does seem rather interesting. It's fascinating because I was on the morning stream earlier this week with Scott Johnson, and mm-hmm. he was saying, you know, the failure of Independence Day and some of these other movies, he thinks that audiences are getting tired of that we're going through sequel fatigue. And I don't think he's wrong, but unfortunately the studios look and say, hey, here's a known property that makes money, whatever it may be. And so, yes, we'll continue to make sequels of them, even though maybe audiences don't want them because that's what the studio thinks is in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
This is the type of stuff that'll make us lots of money. Unfortunately, I think Independence Day kind of proves that. So it'll be interesting to see what happens this week with the BFG. If that again, that's not a sequel, but Legend of Tarzan. I mean, we've seen a million Tarzan movies.
Tarzans.
Purge election year should be rather interesting. And I don't know what its budget was. I bet it says $10 million. For the production budget.
Close.
So if it can make more than, I mean, it's going to be in 2,700 theaters. I think people are interested in some horror type stuff.
It's kind of that horror franchise that's big right now that they kind of pump
out.
I'm sure
it'll do very well this weekend, but it's surprising that when you're looking at a July 4th weekend, that those are your three movies.
Yeah, I know.
And it's really surprising because either Independence Day really was wanting to capitalize on the fact that they had even more days to make money. Because if I remember correctly, the first Independence Day did come out over the July 4th weekend. And I remember standing in line in Atlanta, super hot, waiting to get into that theater. And I'm just really surprised they didn't try to repeat that on this July 4th weekend. But the BFG, that's Steven Spielberg, animation, kids. We saw with Finding Dory that kids and family movies seem to be doing okay. So who knows? This one could be good.
And especially,
has no interest in for me, though.
But. No, you would think a really big movie would want to come out this week, because since 4th of July falls on a Monday, it's a 3-day weekend for most people.
Old
people. Yeah, so it's like a kind of an opportune time to release a big movie.
And the other thing is it's so hot
that,
you know, the only place to go is someplace that's air conditioned. And so you don't want to be outside having a picnic or doing something like that. And so, yeah, let's go to the movies where it's, if we're going to go out of the house and do something, let's go to the movies where it's air conditioned and sit down and watch something good.
Yeah.
So if I had to make a prediction, I think BFG and Finding Dory will have huge success in the theaters again this weekend, simply because they're a family movie, and that's mm-hmm. something you can take the entire family to.
Yeah, especially when, and I don't know, a lot of people, we are officially out of our drought, where there's still like some firework restrictions, and a lot of people that mm-hmm. live, mm-hmm. you know, in certain regions don't get to fire fireworks at all, so right. you might as well take kids yeah, to the yeah. theater so they can have some enjoyment over yeah. that big weekend.
Yeah.
But yeah, Fargo sounds like a great choice instead of the rest of
it. It really
of
is. It is a fantastic movie. You really yeah. should, if you've never seen it before, you really need to see it.
The only thing I know about it is what it's North Dakota or yeah. South Dakota, and there's a wood chipper involved.
Right. Okay. So watch it, man. It's fascinating. It's really fascinating.
All
right.
Yeah. That's a good idea for next week. So what do you think, final thoughts on Hail Caesar?
I enjoyed it tremendously.
Yeah.
I really wish I would have had time to watch it again before our conversation. I do want to watch it again and yeah. probably watch it again. And I bet I could get my wife to watch it again only because it has Channing Tatum in it.
Mm-hmm.
Have you watched Hateful Eight?
Not yet.
She went to see that with me, and Channing Tatum is in it for a very brief amount of time. And then for the rest of the night, she was so upset because of what happened to Channing Tatum in Hateful Eight.
No.
So, yeah, she's like, oh no, Channing Tatum.
I was watching that scene with Channing Tatum, and like, he is kind of this Grace Kelly. I think he gets...
Not Grace Kelly.
Or not Grace Kelly. Who
Fred Astaire.
Thinking? Yeah, Fred Astaire. Why do I keep saying Grace Kelly? Yeah, Fred Astaire. But he gets kind of like looked down on because he did kind of come up as this good-looking guy that can dance, and he was in the what is that, Step Up movies.
Oh,
but
yeah.
I feel like he doesn't get some of the respect that he kind of deserves as an actor, because he is pretty good.
I think he's actually super underrated.
Yeah.
And so it's funny to see, you know, that he's getting a success and really getting noticed, and people are, and that he's willing to laugh at himself too.
Because, mm-hmm.
And have you seen, what is it, the end or whatever the movie is, the end of the world thing
yeah.
that has him in there?
Uh-huh.
It's really good. I mean, he's really good. I like him a lot. I loved him in Magic Mike. I thought that was great.
Yeah, Magic Mike is good.
And, yeah, he really just does a bunch of different things.
Oh, and he was in that, oh crap, what was the movie where everything was yellow and his wife was on like weird pills and stuff? It was a Soderbergh movie.
Oh, I don't know. That
he's in a
really
Soderbergh
good.
Film, and it was, oh, God, what is
well,
it?
Well, and I liked him in 21 Jump good. Street. You know, that was funny there. I don't know. Jupiter Ascending, he was in that.
Oh, no, that was a god-awful movie.
He was
that
in
was
that
bad.
Piece of crap. I don't know. I don't know which movie you're talking about.
Oh, man.
He played Superman in the Lego movie.
People will. Oh, yeah, that's true. People will find. People know what I'm talking about. It's that Soderbergh film with Channing Tatum in it.
There you go.
Came out in like 2011 or something. Yeah, for me, I enjoyed Hail Caesar a lot from what they were attempting to do, the kind of little vignettes. Mm-hmm. It is a weirder movie than you anticipate, I think, from the way it was marketed.
Right.
It is not the movie you're really expecting,
mm-hmm.
and it's definitely weird, but it is a lot of fun. And I think it definitely, if you have enjoyed this podcast from the beginning, like this is a film you should watch because you'll see so many different elements of films we've watched over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that aspect, it's really well done.
You're thinking of Haywire.
No, I am not.
That's the movie you're thinking of. That's the Steven Soderbergh, Channing Tatum movie, Haywire, 2011.
No.
And it's all yellow.
Haywire?
That's what it says. Haywire, 2011, 5.8 out of 10 rating. Steven Soderbergh, Channing Tatum.
Hold on. Now I'm going to find it because that does not even sound close to right.
It's what it says. A black ops super soldier seeks payback after she betrayed and set up after she is betrayed and set up during a mission.
Man, I am not. I am thinking of something completely out wrong because I see Haywire 2 and.
There you go. That's what you gave me all the information.
No,
Steven
you're
Soderbergh,
right.
Yellow, Channing Tatum.
And maybe
you
it's
said
not
his wife is in it. You said his
no,
wife
oh, here
is
it is. Side Effects.
Oh, okay.
Side Effects. Is that Steven Soderbergh? I'm going to feel stupid if it's not. Oh, it is Soderbergh. Good. Side Effects.
What year did that come out?
2000 and... Oh, crap. Press the wrong button. 2013.
Okay, so you were off by 2 years, but
no,
it's funny that...
they've done
that's funny
film.
That they've done the films together. That's
yeah.
weird. Okay.
Side Effects.
All right.
That's a good weird movie.
Okay. Fargo next week.
Fargo is the next movie we're going to watch next week. I hear that's weird, too.
Yeah.
In the meantime, while you're killing some time, head over to majorspoilers.com. Find all of the great comic book news and podcasts. There's so many podcasts. You guys, if you like Zach on Film, you're going to love Major Spoilers Podcast. Check out Munchkinland, Top 5, Critical Hit. Something for everyone. Listen to them, enjoy them, and tell Stephen how much you love them. While you're over at majorspoilers.com, not Stephen, the podcast,
just tell everybody.
Of course.
Yeah. Tell everybody you love their
stuff. We're here at majorspoilers.com. Click on that amazon.com link. You can buy so much stuff from Amazon, Steven. I bought a headset for my new Xbox One today.
Awesome.
I bought an Xbox. And it's like,
did you buy that through Amazon?
No, I bought it at Walmart.
Man.
Yeah, I know. It was a great impulse buy. So you can buy all of your great video game gear or movie gear right from Amazon. The great thing about using that link at Major Spoilers is it's not going to cost you any extra, but a little bit of that money won't go to Amazon. It'll come to Major Spoilers instead, so you can keep enjoying podcasts like this one. So next week, another Coen Brothers film, Fargo, on Zach on Film.